listening to the Miles to Go podcast, the go-to source for travel tips, news, and reviews you can't afford to miss. Now, here's your host, travel expert Ed Pizza.
Hey guys, I'm excited to bring you our first bonus episode of Miles to Go. We published our regular episode earlier this week with all of our normal tips and tricks, but I had the opportunity to show up at the inaugural of a brand new airport terminal. Payne Field, just north of Seattle, has been around for a long time, but for the first time in decades is now offering commercial flights again. And I was on the inaugural flight from Payne Field down to Las Vegas earlier this week, gathered up a couple of friends that have been on the podcast before to talk about what's so special about this terminal and why you might want to consider it for your next trip into the Seattle area. Hope you guys enjoy the show. Welcome back to another episode of the Miles to Go podcast, where we bring you the latest travel news, tips, and tricks each week to help you save money and travel better. And we are turning the format a bit on its side this week. I hijacked Seth's Dots, Lines, and Destinations podcast. His idea was for us to record when we got to Las Vegas after the inaugural flight out of the first brand new airport I can remember flying out of on day one. Payne Field, north of Seattle. So we have decided to record Dots, Lines, and Destinations and Miles to Go at the same time.
We have indeed, and I question your judgment in using the word hijack in related to anything aviation, but you are the senior member of this team, I suppose, and we'll let you get away with that.
I don't believe I'm senior. I guess I'm senior in age.
Yeah, that's what I was giving you. That's what I was calling you old.
Yeah. So I did say we wouldn't curse on the podcast, but hijacking is probably as close as we can get to airline cursing. And there's a third of us
here. He said the H word. What if I'm a bombardier?
Bombardier. Yeah. There you go. We have a third guest with us today, Ben Stolt, who was on the flight with us today and has been with us on countless other Aviation Geek events. And this one was light on, as you mentioned, you were the first one to say it. This one was light on the number of Aviation Geeks that came out to hang from our group.
First off, hello. And yes, I totally agree. Usually when I go to one of these events and I see you guys at these events, there are usually a few dozen other people that I've seen and that are regulars at this sort of thing. And this was a little different, but it was also a much smaller sort of scale event. I mean, a lot of times we do these, it's a major airline like United or American. And
yeah, this was a smaller plane. It's a 70-seater, so there were fewer opportunities for the usual suspects to show up. It also was rescheduled. This flight was supposed to be 3 weeks ago, and because of the government shutdown, some paperwork didn't get finished in time, and so we had to rejigger everything and move stuff around, and it got pushed back a few weeks. But, you know, there weren't as many AvGeek/, you know, dork whatevers that were from our usual circle of friends, but there were plenty on board. My seatmate...
Absolutely.
Yeah, my seatmate was actually a mechanic who works for Horizon, who lives near Payne Field in Everett, up north of town, but works out of SeaTac, and you know, was just mentioning that he normally has his hour to hour and a half drive each way every day for work, and how much nicer it is to have the airport
5 minutes away.
And he did it. He actually got on as a pass rider, so there were some empty seats at the end. And there was actually a couple empty seats on the plane, even when we took off. So
kind of figured with
it
last
cleared out in the last 24 hours. And I'm sure lots of people just schedules didn't work out, or some people were holding seats. And
well, some of them could end up on. So we were technically not on the very first flight.
True.
However, the only other flight that left before us was not technically a commercial flight because you couldn't buy a seat.
Right.
So it was a bunch of
it was scheduled service, but tickets weren't sold to the public. I'm still trying to figure out the right phrasing for all this stuff.
Yeah, it is possible there were some executives or folks that wanted to fly on ours that ended up going on that Portland flight.
Sure, because much like ours, it was a quick turn, and if they could get out and back, it's a shorter flight. They could get home quicker or back to Everett quicker.
To frame this up for folks who may not be as geeky as we are.
We probably should have introduced what we actually did.
Right. So
that would probably be helpful.
Yeah. So Seattle-Tacoma International Airport is
is the airport in Seattle. And it's big and it's massive, and it can be cumbersome for two reasons. One is just the sheer volume of folks going in and the security lines in certain areas of the airport. And so that's been a growing concern. The other thing is that traffic in the Seattle area is not pleasant at large chunk of the day. And Ben, you know this because you live in the area.
Especially true if you're in the northern side of Seattle. You pretty much are going through the worst of it.
Yeah.
Either in the morning or in the evening to battle your way down to SeaTac. There are, of course, some public transit connections, but they're mostly useful if you're actually downtown.
Right.
Not quite so much if you're, you know, in the outskirts of town or, you know, approaching suburbia.
Yeah, I mean, I use the Link Rail to get from SeaTac up into town as part of my trip this weekend, and it's great. It doesn't help the fact that it's still like really far away. I mean, it's all relative.
It's
this is coming from a guy
30,
who used to live.
40 minute drive. Yeah.
It's coming from a guy who used to live in New York City. Where everything, all the airports were physically closer, but time-wise much further.
Exactly.
To say that, you know, on mass transit, certainly, to say that, you know, this is a long ride on the Link Rail is, like, embarrassing and stupid. But it does feel a little longer because you're running at full speed along, like, the highway for so much of it. And, like,
that's true.
You feel how far out of town it is. But then also, from SeaTac to downtown is only half the distance if you want to get up to Everett. It's literally like you double it to get all the way up to the other side.
Definitely double the distance. And I mean, I think the real target audience is those that are on the northern side of Seattle. When you're driving up there, you're actually driving against rush hour traffic.
Right.
Once you hit I-5, like I did this morning, it's smooth sailing and while the other side's a parking lot trying to go south. So there's an audience that are gonna like these flights. And the question is going to be, are the frequencies and the timings going to work out for people to get where they ultimately
And so I
go?
Think what's interesting is, you know, I've been racking my brain trying to come up with other airport openings around the world. Forget just the United States, but even around the world, and come up with examples that are actual new service and not replacement terminals or sort of shifting of one building to another. So you're like, Singapore is an extra terminal. They added a T4 right at Changi. You've got a couple other examples. Mexico City was supposed to be a new airport, and then that whole deal was a disaster and fell apart, we think, but maybe not, but half the construction's done, so who knows? And just, I've been going through this list of trying to come up with an example.
But it's the same location. It's not that far off from where it was.
Mexico's?
Yeah?
No, it's a new runways, new everything.
Okay.
A few, you know, 20 miles further out, so, or something like that. It is a new, both new airport and new terminals. And this is technically an existing airport, but new terminal and new commercial service that hasn't existed for
a long
many,
time.
Many decades.
It's technically not a brand new service, but it has been quite a while.
Yeah, since the 1940s, I think.
Has it been that long?
60s? I don't know. It's been decades.
Okay.
It was the 40s was the last time it had regular commercial service, and then starting in the 80s, the first serious push began. And looping back to frequencies, I think a couple of things to touch on for folks that that aren't familiar with Painfield, north of Seattle by a decent distance, going to be served by both Alaska and United.
Yeah,
9 total destinations, a bunch in California, the major ones, L.A., San Francisco, San Jose.
San Diego.
San Diego, Orange County. We also pick up a little further afield, Phoenix and Denver.
And Las Vegas.
And I pulled up – and Las Vegas since we just did that.
Which is where we are right now.
And I pulled up the time frames. And so Portland gets some of the most frequent service. And so you've got morning flights, 6:30 a.m., so being able to catch the first connections. You've got – Portland, San Francisco, Denver, San Jose, LAX, all before 8 a.m. So those are all 6:30 and 7 a.m. departures. And then midday banks for LA and San Francisco to catch sort of the afternoon flights out of LA. And then as you get to the evening, you've got a 5:30 p.m. to Las Vegas, which I think will be a popular flight for the weekends.
Sharks
are going down. And then evening flights, you've got a San Francisco flight that lands that leaves at 7 p.m., lands at 9:30. That's probably a bit too late to make too many of the connections. I mean, there are some real late San Francisco-Asia connections.
There's all the midnight departures to Asia, and Alaska Airlines has some of those partners.
Yep, and then you've got a 10 p.m. Into LAX and a 7 p.m. departure lands at 10 p.m. at LAX. 7:45 out of Painfield going to San Diego lands at 10:35. The only thing I question maybe with a 10 p.m. arrival is, depending on where you land at an airport like L.A., you know, can you get to a different terminal?
Yeah, and I think those will meet the minimum connection time requirements still. Yeah. Whether it's smart or not remains to be seen. But also, remember that a lot of the goal with this is the local traffic, much more than the connecting. There's 75 or 70-seat airplanes. They're running E-75s, yeah. It was interesting on board hearing some people chatting. One of the things I love about inaugural flights is everybody's more talkative.
Yes.
Normally you get on an airplane and there's a whole lot of people like put their blinders on and is leaving me alone. And this, everybody's talking to everybody. And I was listening to the guys in front of me chatting who didn't know each other, both bought tickets just to be on this first flight.
For sure.
And raving about the Embraer and how big the seats are and how comfortable it is. Raving about, you know, the experience on board, but also talking about how, you know, one of them has family in Denver and he's really looking forward to using that. The station manager from Alaska Airlines has a daughter in college in Phoenix, and so she's happy to be able to get down there to see her daughter more easily. It's, a lot of it is the local traffic, and with the smaller planes, you can fill them up pretty regularly. I think, you know, the United flights are go to San Francisco and Denver, which is always going to be the hubs because of what it is. It's not,
right.
But Alaska Airlines is treating this as not quite a hub, mm-hmm. but sort of. It's a little bit of a mini hub for them. And with 18 flights a day, again, it's not enough necessarily, but it's the most they could get. And I think it does meet your business traveler schedule. You've got morning and evening flights, so you can do day trips.
Well, and you've also got, for certain airports, you've got three or four times a day.
Yeah,
you know, right. Portland and San Francisco, which I think – so, you know, Ben, you live in Seattle, not far from downtown.
Right.
And so from your standpoint, when you think about the destinations here, what percentage of the time do you think you'd end up using Painfield in a vacuum versus Seattle Tacoma in the future?
It's tough. The one tricky bit is if you're local and you're driving up there, if you're leaving out of Payne, you pretty much have to come back that way if you're leaving your car. So that's something you have to keep in mind. Can you make it work on both ends of a trip?
Right.
And for me, it's going to be a lot more the can I connect? In my case, American is going to be the big one there.
Right.
So I can see myself using it to hop down to L.A. I find myself doing that a lot.
Or San Francisco, probably.
But American doesn't have that much out of San Francisco. But
right.
You could put something together.
Yeah.
And depending on time of day, it's about equal for us. But like for this morning, doing this drive down to SeaTac at 8 o'clock in the morning would have been brutal.
Yeah.
That would have been a solid hour. Driving up there was 40 minutes, mostly just because where I particularly live in Seattle, it's a little awkward to get over to I-5.
Right.
But once you're on there, boom, it's fast. Like, 75% of the distance is, 30% of the drive.
Open highway. Yeah. No, that's the impression I got from a lot of people is like, even those who are equidistant are looking at it like, on a Sunday, it might be equal drive time, but 90% of the time it's going to be faster to.
And you also need to take into account at SeaTac, you have to lock a lot of little extra time. I mean, you can have pre-check and clear all day long. Right. It can be a mess just to approach the terminal.
Yeah.
The terminal was packed today with two flights worth, but the facilities, they had three security lanes theoretically.
Yeah.
Well, they had real pre-check on day one, which is, I think, pretty cool.
Yeah. And I think the other thing too, for folks, when you talk about putting this in context, especially compared to bigger airports, I think there's two things to think about where this airport, I think, compares favorably to both big and small airports. First, on the big scale, this airport's literally never going to have more than two planes worth of people waiting. Now, the planes may get bigger, but for right now, what that means with both Alaska and United flying an Embraer 75, you're talking about max roughly 150 people max hanging out in the terminal. And so we counted today there are over 260 seats. So there's certainly
– And there's actually going to be more. The podium took up about six seats worth of space, so add that to your list.
Yeah, so there's enough seats for everyone to spread out. As you say, like even if you got behind all 70 people, waiting for your flight to get through security. I can't imagine it would take all that long with three security lanes. On the flip side, when we think about small airports that we've all flown into and out of, and I've done a bunch on business travel, very infrequently do they have jet service.
Right.
So there's one benefit. And none of them have the sort of comfort level that this terminal had. A lot of them don't have real pre-check.
Definitely highlight that. I mean, sitting at the terminal was like sitting in an airport lounge.
It feels like a lounge. It feels like a fancy hotel lobby. I mean, Ed, you and I were joking around about the seats, the chairs that we were sitting in. Like, maybe we'll just stay here. These are more comfortable than like... you know, anywhere else we've been. I looked them up. They're $4,000 chairs. I'm assuming that this guy's got a discount buying in volume, but
I'm sure that was also custom leather.
Yeah. So, and it was not a color scheme set that was available on the website directly. So, you know, it was a super comfortable, super swanky experience. The bar, like, looked like a fancy hotel bar to me. It really had that vibe. One of the things you mentioned, though, in terms of amenities, there's no facilities inside. There's minimal facilities inside. There's the bar. There's going to be a Beecher's cheese shop, which I imagine will have some sandwiches and stuff.
There's also going to be there's also one other small thing that's going in.
Is there going to be a newsstand?
Not a newsstandy thing. We'll look it up and add it. But there was the wine bar and Beecher's, and I thought there was a third thing that was in the press releases.
Okay.
But you know, when Beecher's opens, I'm guessing that'll be the place that will sell
the bottled water,
and stuff like that, because they're selling sandwiches.
Yeah.
So
well, it's a Beecher's at SeaTac. That's exactly what they do. They have the cheese, they have sandwiches, and you have like chips and
a cooler that you can pull snacks out of.
Yeah, I mean, drinks and stuff.
It's just so that's the one drawback of the small airport. Now the flip side is you're not going to be there connecting, right? So you don't have a weird layover, and you're not going to be there 3 hours early because you don't need to be. I look around and every time I try to come up with words, swanky is the best adjective I've come up with, and it felt like a lounge. Everybody's got great views.
Well, that's the thing, the floor to ceiling windows everywhere, very little in the way of visible impediments. They built it so you could look out the windows
towards the mountains, past the airplanes, some great sight lines. I did find it amusing that the CEO of the airport management company mentioned today, we had such beautiful weather, blue skies, it was crazy, not a cloud to be seen. He's like, we actually didn't realize just how clear the view sight lines were. We're going to have to put in some window coverings on the other side because we're getting too much light in, and it's like distracting and blinding and hitting weird reflections. So yay Seattle, I guess. But there was some funny little bits like that they're realizing when the weather turns out to be really, really good.
When Seattle is nice, it's nice.
Yeah.
But the problem is...
it's also one of those things that, it's brand new and they haven't had a full year of sort of, where the sun is going to be and all those cycles to know what the problems are. And the good news is it sounds like they're going to be pretty responsive and reactive to fixing them when they can.
Yeah, and I think, going a step further into the luxuries that they have at this airport terminal that you just don't see elsewhere, I think there were two other things that struck me. I'm not a local, but I think locals will really appreciate the fact that the valet parking, they will literally have the car parked outside the terminal when you get there. And that's a 100-foot walk from your plane.
And so not even valet, just the normal paid parking.
Well, normal paid parking is another 20 feet past that.
Yeah.
And then the other thing, too, which I really like, but, I'm sort of like a sanitation wonk, all of the restrooms in the terminal are all single doors. They're all individual bathrooms where you can lock a door.
And multi-gender, whatever.
It's very easy, openable, clean, easy to clean, that sort of stuff. I think as long as they do a good job of keeping that stuff clean, I think it's just all those little things that you get in an upscale lounge. And I think the interesting thing is you're not paying any extra for any of that. The most expensive ticket out of Payne Field right now is $120. Now, I'm sure that'll go up a bit at some point if the demand's there, but there are tickets as cheap as $40 right now. So you're certainly not paying more for this privilege.
Right.
No, but that's also, it's a new service and the airlines have to build awareness, build market, build demand. Mm-hmm. And so things are being sold super cheap to get there, right? I mean, this morning they also Southwest Airlines also announced the Hawaii service. And it's not like no one knew it was coming and no one knew that there was demand, but they still sold tickets for $49 just to sort of get the media news out there and make that sort of thing happen. So
for sure. And we may see that. I think when you talk about the the capacity here. That's if they keep them as Embraer 75s. I did the math before we hopped on the plane today, and I think it was like 656,000-ish is like the capacity for the year.
Okay.
So, I mean, that sounds like a lot, but when you break it down to 24 departures a day times 140, that's, what, like 2,000 passengers a day?
Sure.
So, it sounds like a lot when you mash the number all together, but 2,000, as you say, it's more than we would expect to find at a small airport in a small community. This is not a small community, so these flights really could fill up.
Yeah, and it's what's really interesting to me, another thing about it is, I mean, they're taking a month to sort of scale up to full operations because trying to start 24 flights a day, day one, would be crazy. But they really are going aggressive in filling this up quickly,
yeah,
and trying to make sure they get the full value for this, the investment of building out the airport and making sure it happens. 24 daily flights at a new airport is unheard of. There's one new airport that I found somewhere in the middle of Serbia is the only other one I've been able to find that's a legit new, wow, like new terminal, new field, give them an IATA code and let's start service. And that's one that's opening this summer where the government is hoping to get two or three flights a day.
Right.
And which makes it tough to sustain a brand new terminal.
Yeah. Ooh, Janet departing. Sorry, we're sitting in Las Vegas and we've got views of the airport and a Janet 737 that doesn't really exist, just departed.
Bright shiny light. Seth is easily distracted.
It's a fancy special plane.
It is.
Squirrel.
I do wonder.
Sorry.
I do wonder as time goes on, the departures are spread out fairly well across a day.
Even
when you talk about, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., there's 2, 4, 6, 7 departures in that middle chunk of the day, which are certainly less convenient for business travelers. And there are some business traveler destinations in there. There's a Portland, L.A., San Francisco, 2 San Franciscos, a Phoenix. I could see some of those maybe start to slide earlier and later if the demand's not there.
They can't.
I think they could.
So your problem is gate utilization. They only have 2 contact gates plus a hard stand, so they can sort of overflow to the third when they absolutely have to.
Right, but as I look at the times, let's look at the morning right now. I'm going to read off the morning times to you. 6:30, 2:06 a.m.
Okay.
So that's
blocked.
There's
the two planes that stay overnight.
Yep. There's a 6:30,
mm-hmm,
1:07,
mm-hmm,
1:07:30,
mm-hmm,
1:08, 1:08:30, then a 9:20, then a 10:40.
Okay.
So I think there's some room there in that like 7 to 9 block where you could slide another flight or two if you had to.
Yeah, you can basically do every half hour and alternate them, but the planes need an hour to turn.
1 hour.
Sure.
And so you have to alternate the gates. And so part of that is going to be cooperation between United and Alaska to, figure out who's using which one when. But yes, if you do every half hour for 24 departures, that's a 12-hour window, and they're actually working against 16 hours. So there's a little bit of slippage.
Yeah.
Or room for slippage, but not a ton.
No,
and so you can't do 6 departures in the 6 o'clock hour.
No, but right now they do have – I guess you couldn't do 6, but you could probably do 4 or 5 with the hard stands.
You could do 3 if all three at the beginning of an hour with the 2 gates plus a hard stand. And then as those first planes push back, you immediately tow in the other planes that sat overnight and get them out at the bottom of the hour. No, it would be because you've got to start boarding –
yeah,
you got to start boarding 30 minutes earlier. If the plane's got a 6 o'clock departure, you close the door at 6, you push it back, it clears the gate space at 6:05, 6:10. You pull the new one in at 6:15 and you start boarding immediately. It's a 6:45 departure. It's really hard.
Yeah, there's still plenty of gaps at night, too, because once you get past the 5:30, 6 o'clock flight, there's a 7. There's 2 7s and a 9.
So yeah, there's
room to slide stuff around. But I guess the other question will be too: do we think, based on as we look in our crystal ball? Last time Seth was on my podcast, which was just last week, when we talked about the A380. We made a date to have him come back on in
12 years,
12 or 13 years, to see if the A380 would still be flying. So as we look in the crystal ball 6 months from now, do we think it's more likely that they try and move the schedule around and/or add more departures, or do you think it's more likely that they upgauge one of these flights first?
Upgauge over additional flights because the 24 number is a hard cap.
Is it a hard cap?
It is.
I know the environmental review.
The environmental review is set at 24.
Well, okay. They said that it wasn't going to cause significant damage, so I didn't know that it was hard.
So one of the reasons it was delayed is that the original environmental review was for 12.
Right.
And that was signed off on. But when they went to go to 24, they had to do a new environmental impact statement review, and that required a new sign off and a new. So could it go from 24? Could it grow? Right. Yes, with a new review, but right. also you need the county to agree to allow the extra flights.
Right.
There's a lot of moving parts, and while everybody we talked to was super excited about this, we were also at the airport with a bunch of av geeks. There are people in the community that are less excited about it. There's a reason it took 40 years for service sure. to return. You know, the folks sitting behind me were talking, they live super close and they're super happy about it, but they said they've been in the community and they've been fighting we'll stay on the good side, but fighting the good fight for generations to try to make sure, to try to bring service back. And yeah. there are people in the community that are already disappointed that they live under, you know, the test flights for the jumbos.
Right.
And don't want more flights there. It's the same thing in Long Beach. There's plenty of room in Long Beach, California, for more flights.
Yeah.
But they have a cap that says, and it's a noise agreement, essentially, right. that says they are limited to a certain number of flights every day.
Yeah.
Funny thing is these little planes, Embraers are so much quieter. They're very modern and quiet.
Yeah.
And Boeing's got all the heavies coming in and out.
Yeah.
Yeah, the heavies definitely make a lot more noise.
And I still laugh. It's the same problem the NIMBYs in Toronto who voted down.
Billy Bishop, yeah.
Billy Bishop, which is the lakefront airport there, who voted down.
They voted down regional jets, didn't they?
Getting regional jets in, and it was going to be the quietest regional jets. It was going to be was C-Series at the time, now the A220s, which are actually quieter in most phases of flight, including most parts of the takeoff and landing sequence, I think, than the Q400s.
And, oh, by the way, would have supported the Canadian economy.
Yeah.
Yes.
And helped drop airfares because Porter Air would have expanded massively. All good things were going to come out of this, except for the people who owned the waterfront real estate were going to see the C-Series instead of some Q400s. And it likely would have increased the number of flights, and I can understand from that perspective why they didn't like it, but such a short-sighted, terrible decision. So
I think it is also key to note here that on top of, as you mentioned, the resistance in the community to potentially another environmental review that might increase takeoffs and landings is what appears to be a fervent desire to have this airport not be referred to as the Seattle second airport.
Everett's
first airport is apparently the more popular way to refer to it in the area.
It was, I read a headline, there's a Sunday only, I think, Everett Times, every Gazette, I don't know, some newspaper that was in the lobby of the hotel when we checked in on Sunday night. And the front page articles, two front page articles, both about the airport. And the first one above the fold was people complaining that they keep calling it Seattle's airport. And the bottom one was like, there's valet parking and fast Wi-Fi and all the new amenities you're going to get. But the first above the fold front page of the local newspaper was, why the hell do they keep calling this Seattle's second airport when it's really ours?
Yeah.
I think that's hysterical. And so, yeah, it's all the speeches this morning. You know, one of the guys we used to call SeaTac, runs a county, the county commissioner or whatever.
Sure. Yeah, we'll go.
Was like, we used to call SeaTac the southern gateway to Snohomish County. Now, now we have our own airport, so we don't need them anymore. It was pretty cute.
That's great. So I think the moral of the story is that this airport is such a long time coming, and then really opens with a bang with the number of flights that are going out of it. It's great that there are all these great amenities and all that stuff, but I think the impression that I was left with is, you've got 24 daily departures up from zero.
Yeah, it's going to be a huge shift for the community, a huge boon to the community, and will help shift a decent amount of traffic. One of the things we talk about a lot, me and my brain, I think, I'm just talking to myself.
That little green guy that you walk around
with. Yeah, my Senior X. Now he's way too chill to talk about airplanes with me. You hear about the growth in air travel and how infrastructure has to grow to support it. And I spend a lot of time with the folks at IATA talking about how is the industry going to evolve and air traffic control and airports and all these things. And mega hubs are full, and it's really hard to grow them. And secondary airports and tertiary airports are going to be part of the solution there, and overflying the hubs. And this is a great example of it. Not only did they do it, but like you said, they did it with a sizable chunk of traffic. This is, maybe it's only 600,000 passengers a year to start, but they upgauge those to 737s, that number more than doubles.
Yeah.
And they can, you know, slowly build them as they need to.
Now, what they did have to their advantage is they didn't have to build most of the airport infrastructure. They had to build the little terminal.
Sure.
But Payne Field is a massive airport, the runways are oversized for its general aviation population, thanks to Boeing.
Yeah, right. Super long runway and all the
facilities. Anything can land there, pretty much.
Yeah, it's a 12,000-foot runway, I think.
I mean, they'd bring in the Dreamlifter, so that's about the biggest thing.
Yeah, we also mentioned, too, that there was already catering there. You know, so a lot of the existing facilities that you'd need to build to support an airport were already in existence. And I also, too, wonder how much of the Boeing traffic that goes out of SeaTac now for folks that are at Everett now, it's so much easier for those guys.
Executives and stuff like that.
Yeah, I have to assume that a decent chunk of this traffic, there's a commitment from Boeing to a certain volume for their executives as well. I mean, none of it goes to Chicago yet.
Sure.
Which is technically where headquarters is.
Yep.
But there is still, you know, up and down the coast, you go to Southern California for a lot of the seating and entertainment and interiors companies are down there with facilities. So there is a lot of traffic within the region. Or Portland, just for the paint shops and things like that. I mean,
it would surprise me United didn't throw in a Chicago route in their initial offering.
I think even though it would be a long time to be on a regional jet, I think that that's technically long enough. The plane technically has enough range to make it.
Yeah, or you switch to a 319 for the 120 seats.
Sure.
And both airlines could do that because Alaska has the Virgin ones.
Or you could do the new
C-Series, the A220?
Not the A220, the new United 50-seater.
Oh, the CRJ-550?
Yeah.
You know what? You laugh, but that would be an interesting play. This would be an interesting market for that.
Yeah, it could be very right-sized for this market, especially because if you think about the executives that would move back and forth, you would likely have premium demand.
Yeah. So. I know that United wanted to keep those on shorter stage lengths.
For sure.
I think 1,000 miles was the target number, and this is much more than that.
This is just a wee bit more.
A little bit.
About 1,800, but I don't know. It'll be interesting. So
final impressions. Ben, having been through the airport for the day, what did you take away from it?
Great new facilities. I mean, you walk in there, you feel like you're in a nice, modern, you know, executive almost like experience. It doesn't feel like as run-of-the-mill airport, so I thought it was fun. One thing we didn't even point out, they have this fun digital schedule wall in the front lobby that's supposed to emulate like the old school German style flipping.
I think they're technically Italian. I hate to break it to you.
Or fine, but I mean, you commonly see them in Germany. But.
Yeah,
I do wonder if I didn't hear it. Obviously, and I don't know if there is noise, but I also didn't see it flip today.
No, it didn't
I flip. Saw one of the some of the numbers flipping as they put a gate assignment up. Honestly, it was pretty disappointing.
There's not enough traffic to really make them flip all day long.
It's just TV screens, so it's animated, and I was disappointed.
They had a little fun with it. I feel like they were really into making it a unique experience.
They wanted to do my complaint slash you know kvetch. There is there are companies that make new fake Solaris that are actually clickety clack and reliable.
Isn't there one in the business class lounge in Sydney, Qantas?
I don't
when you
know.
Come to the, when you come to the top of the escalator, I think there's a small one.
I don't know.
Yeah. I have never been. No, it's not true. I did it once, but the domestic, actually, when I did my departure from there. So anyway, I was a little disappointed in that overall. I respect the effort, but found myself very saddened to learn that it was pretty fake and not as fun.
So overall, I say positive experience.
Yeah.
Would try it again.
Yeah. Seth, what's your final
Would fly again.
Yeah, exactly.
Thumbs up. No, listen, it feels like a cross between an executive terminal FBO private facility and commercial space and our commercial airport lounge. And, you know, I keep thinking back to the last new terminal I attended, the opening for was Long Beach, which was 5 or 6 years ago now in Southern California. Yeah. And they did outdoor seating and like similar sort of fancy hotel resort type lobby experience.
Yeah.
And similar small number of departures, they could get away with it. They actually did outdoor space there because of Southern California.
Like a fire table out there.
They've got a fire pit and things like that. And
so nice.
The guys up here have a fire pit. It's enclosed, not open space, but they have two of them actually, one on either side. So it really does have that luxury vibe to it that eventually I actually think as the market establishes, people are going to start paying a premium to fly from here.
Yeah.
I just, you know, even if I was in the area, I would even consider paying a little extra to fly from there. It is spectacularly convenient as long as it's convenient for you to get to.
Yeah.
The one negative other than the Solari clock display is transit right now is a debacle. Like the nearest bus services I was reading about is like take this bus or that bus and then walk 9 minutes in. It was actually the bus stop across the street where our driver almost dropped us off this morning. That was the bus stop, and then you have to walk that sidewalk.
It looks like there's something in flight, though, because there is a bus station literally right at the entrance of the parking lot.
Yeah, they're changing. So what I read,
they're going to move some.
I think it's coming.
Yeah, what I read is that there is a link system coming where like you'll take the train halfway, and then there'll be an express bus service. What I heard was every 10 minutes on the on weekdays, and every 20 minutes on the weekends, it will go to the terminal. So if that is the case. I don't love switching from train to bus.
I'll get over that. I mean, I travel to LaGuardia too often.
For sure. Yeah. I love using the train, but I think, you know, train to bus, if it's an efficient connection and you really can hop in 10 or 20 minutes from one to the other, then I could see that being popular for folks downtown who don't have a car.
Yeah. I think that's going to be a drawback for the facility for some time.
Yeah.
Overall, blew me away. Really, really impressed.
Yeah, and then I guess my final moment, the first thing I'd say, everything I've read about the gentleman that pioneered the project, you know, they made just a ton of right decisions.
Except trying to break that champagne bottle.
Well,
this
is literally what I was going to come to. I don't want to leave with this negative moment because they really did such an awesome job. But
it was hysterical.
There will be video up on my blog at some point of he had a bottle of, I think it was Vuv.
Yeah.
And so he was going to break it against the side of the building to christen it.
And he said, "May God bless this terminal," and missed six times.
Six times. And he hit the bottle hard against the building.
I thought it was going to chip the, it was like stone, like sandstone walls. Yeah. I thought it was going to chip the stones.
He may have. We should have inspected that before we left. You know, I had seen all the images of it during construction, and so I can't say that I was more impressed than I was expecting to be from that standpoint because it looked incredible in the press in the press previews. It fit all of that. I think the thing that I really loved that I took away was the folks that were serving us there. Now, I understand that, you know, it was an inaugural party and all that, but all the folks that were serving us were the folks that were running the bar and were running Beechers. And you know, and the agents that were there at the gates, it was you take everything else that was there and you take a bunch of people that just really want to be there. And from a friction standpoint as a business traveler, there was nothing there to stress me out. I literally could have fallen asleep in that chair.
Yeah.
And so when you add all that up and say how much friction there is and what we deal with.
We went through security twice and it was easy both times.
Yeah. Insanely easy. So, I mean, from all that standpoint to say that you can make the travel experience that much more frictionless for me, as you say, those are the things that would probably make me willing to pay a premium.
Yeah. I agree. And the good news is he did eventually pop the cork off the champagne bottle and then was able to smash it once it was empty. And so we got broken glass everywhere.
We don't. We are no longer
there. They got broken glass everywhere. Someone's got to go clean up the garden. But
We did not do the turn. We are staying overnight in Las Vegas, although I'm continuing on for work while you guys head to various places tomorrow.
But, that was great. Well, I'm going to close my version of the show and then let you close yours, and that'll be fun. You've been listening to Dots, Lines, and Pizza here.
And Ben.
Now, go ahead and close that.
I don't know how many more times we're going to do joint Dots, Lines, and Pizza episodes for the Miles to Go and Dots, Lines, Destinations podcast, but I know I had fun.
Absolutely.
And hopefully there's a listener or two out there who enjoyed it and will write us and say that they want us to do it again.
But until then, we've got miles to go.